Before the world began to unravel, there used to be travel. Well, they're moving about a bit more in the northern hemisphere, but in the global south, where in many countries COVID has still got us in its clutches, and in places where vaccines are scarce, or in Australia's case, where many of us are in lockdown while we play the waiting game, travel is the stuff of dreams. And travel writing might be our best bet to tie us over. Good travel writers have always been a joy, but they've often been of a certain type. The privileged Westerner traipsing through exotic foreign parts, this is now changing. Tim Hannigan has been studying those who study others. He's written a book called The Travel Writing Tribe. Now, Tim is not himself a travel writer, but he's a very keen consumer of the genre. His own narrative history books include A Brief History of Indonesia and Raffles and the British Invasion of Java. And he's also an academic here and there. Tim hails from Cornwall. He's based in Ireland, and we welcome him to our little wireless program, Aldertonians with Colonialist Tendencies. I think that's how The Guardian worded it in a review of your book. Would you introduce us to that particular type of travel writer?
Yes, and thanks for having me. Yeah, the Aldertonians unmistakably do have a prominent position in British travel writing over the last 100-150 years, really. You know, we know that travelers, writers, people in, as you say, the Conservative Party and everything else are tend to be from a privileged background. But when you dig into travel writing, it really is quite astonishing how prominent Eton and Oxford turn out to be. You have people like Peter Fleming, people like Robert Byron, people like Wilfred Thesiger, all from the mid-20th century, but right up to much more recently, like Rory Stewart, Colin Thubron. Eton just seems to have produced travel writers like nowhere else.
I'm interested in Patrick Lee Fermor, who was kicked out of, and I quote, kicked out of more than one boarding school. An alarmed housemaster once described him as a dangerous mixture of sophistication and recklessness. They would seem to be appropriate attributes.
Well, they would. And I think this is possibly where that kind of travel writing impulse came from amongst those people of that kind of background. Lee Fermor wasn't at Eton, and he probably wouldn't have lasted if he had been, and he didn't make it to university either. But there is something in that kind of that sort of entitlement, that sense of openness to the world, that allowed those people as young men to go off. And you know, I do always make the point that of all the things an Aldertonian could do with their privilege, becoming a travel writer is probably slightly less dangerous than becoming prime minister.
Well, let's face it, you didn't have to be dazzlingly educated to fit into your genre. Colin Thubron suffered from what is described as a growing tally of educational miscarriages. He sat his maths O-level at Eton three times and failed by a wider margin each time. I warm to him too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's another thing that I think is always important to say, that these people who've dominated the travel genre until pretty recently do come from a background of entitlement and privilege, but many of them have a slightly sort of sideways approach. They've not gone on the regular path straight up to the cabinet of the British government. They've had to go sideways. And Colin Thubron's a great example of that. And you know, Colin Thubron's a great example of somebody from that background who's an incredibly sensitive and careful and engaged reporter of the world. So we ought not to be too quick to assume that just because they come from that background, they have to be problematic. But it's a pattern that's interesting.
You have an interesting thesis about tribalism, arguing in effect that the Eton tribalism has its echo in this profession.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the kind of fascination that all of these mid and late 20th century travel writers have with what to them were exotic cultures, there's often a gravitation towards groups that are sort of outside the mainstream of settled society in whatever country or culture it is. So the Bedouin tribes people of the Middle East are the ones that come up all the time. You've got Bruce Chatwin's fascination with nomadic societies all over the world. And I have a suspicion that that's something to do with the fact that as public schoolboys, young men who were at boarding school, who were often dressed differently from the people who they might bump into in the surrounding area, they had this kind of this sense of themselves as a discrete tribe, separate from everyone else, and that predilection for looking for people who are somehow similarly different, visibly different, culturally different in other places has something to do with that as well.
Tim, one needs to have some privilege to be able to go on long remote trips, not earning a living for long periods.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing that you always have to remember. It takes a certain amount of money to do these things, but in an age of declining advances for writers. Now, you know, travel writing has definitely become wider and more diverse in terms of who does it these days, but still, it tends to be something done from at very least a middle class point of departure, just because, you know, you need that starting point to get out there into the world. Hopefully it might continue to become more open and more diverse. But travel is in itself, if it's elective travel you choose to do, it's a thing of privilege. And there's lots of people on journeys that are not elective, they're journeys that are compelled, and that's a very different story.
My guest is Tim Hannigan, who's now going to introduce us to some of the interesting travel writers emerging and explain what makes them different.
Yeah, so there was this critique of travel writing. It was a kind of academic critique in the 80s, 90s, and even in the last 20 years, that it was very much a privileged white and male genre. And I think sometimes the idea slipped in that was kind of intrinsic to it, that wasn't just the staff of the genre at that particular time. It wasn't an HR issue. It was somehow intrinsic to it. Those were the only people who did travel writing. And I don't think that was ever true. And I think in the last decade or so, that's become increasingly apparent because there are different voices. And, you know, some of the most interesting writers and people I met while I was working on the book, on the Travel Writing Tribe, people who are now prominent don't come from that background.
Let's look at Capka Kasabova. So she's born in Bulgaria, grew up in New Zealand. She's lived in France, South America, Scotland. You describe her as a serial immigrant.
Yeah, and I think Capka Kasabova is really the kind of archetype of the travel writer of today, the person who's equipped to deal with the 21st century world. She has that continuous movement in her own background, that continuous sort of uncertainty about where exactly she's departing from. Now her books have mostly been about the part of the world she originally comes from, Southeast Europe. So she comes to that place with her own heritage and her own links and her own language skills for that area, but at the same time from a kind of distance, from a remove. So she's a sort of insider-outsider in that place. And I think other writers like Noor Wiwa, like Manisha Rajesh, they bring something of that to their travel writing as well. That insider-outsider quality, which makes for really interesting travel writing.
Tim, some years ago, the program became absolutely fascinated by the Nigerian activist Ken Sarawiwa, and now you introduce us to his daughter, Noo. Tell me about Noo.
Yeah, so I mean, she's another writer who I like Capka Kasabova has that degree of insider-outsider quality when she writes about Nigeria. So she's British, she grew up in Britain, but her heritage, her family came from Nigeria. So she went to Nigeria, traveled there extensively for a really wonderful book called Looking for Trans Wonderland. And what she's able to bring is obviously that personal connection, that personal family connection with a place, which is also in a way a place that's distant and to some degree foreign to her, because she's coming from the UK when she travels there. But she has that degree of insight and ability to actually be critical and be sharp about the place that, well, I certainly would be less comfortable and less able to do. So I think sometimes that insider-outsider quality allows people to have a sharper eye and a stronger voice in the company.
We're in the company of someone who has some connection, a lived connection.
That's it. And that's what people, those writers I mentioned, and Kapka Kasabova is another one, they bring, you know. You want in a travel book, you want some sense of a journey to a place. You want a sense that the person is traveling from somewhere to a place. And those writers are doing that, but they're not just turning up in a place that is a blank, a place that they have no connection to. And that's what makes it interesting. Look, I don't want to say that's the only kind of people who should be writing travel books. I don't want to say if you want to write a travel book about Indonesia, you need to have been born in Indonesia and then brought up in Australia, or your parents need to have been born in Indonesia and you've grown up in the Netherlands or whatever. That's not the only kind of people who are allowed to do travel writing. I mean, I'm still very happy for Colin Thubron to head off to Russia and write a travel book. But it does make for an interesting dynamic when you have that insider-outsider perspective.
Let's talk about one of your heroes, Philip Marsden.
Yeah, Philip Marsden was the writer that the book began with, and he's a writer from that sort of privileged white male background that dominated travel writing all the way through the 20th century. But at the same time, you know, he's one who has that sensitivity, that insight, that carefulness. He's very much a kind of heir to Colin Thubron's tradition of writing, but he was where I began with. That's where the whole book started. I was asked by a magazine to go and interview Philip Marsden, who lives in Cornwall, which is where I'm from. And it was a short magazine profile, but I went to meet him at his home, which is a wonderful sight on the edge of the River Fowell in South Cornwall. Anyway, we ended up having about a 4-hour conversation about the ethics and the tangled issues around travel writing, the line between fiction and nonfiction. And that was really what sparked the whole idea. I came away from that conversation thinking, gosh, I could just carry on doing this. I could go to meet all of the travel writers I admire and ask them the same questions. And that's where the book came from.
Now, I want to get on to the ethics issues in just a minute, but you discuss with him the make or break element of a travel tale, that is, the writer putting themselves at the centre of the story. I mean, it's clear you'll hate a book if you don't like the author.
Yes, look, I mean, that's the sort of the vulnerability that's there in travel writing. And I think Philip Marsden really sort of got to the bottom of that idea in that conversation. You know, when you read an academic book, or indeed a sort of narrative history book of the kind that I've previously written, you don't typically see the author. There's no first person. You don't get an eye narrating it. And there's an element of a sort of affected voice of God in that. There's an assumed authority. But as soon as the book is written in the first person, you can see the subjectivity. You can see the author moving through the subject or moving through the landscape. And suddenly the fact that this is a subjective journey, it's a journey of discovery, is revealed. And Philip Marsden said that, you know, this is the difference between travel writing and academic writing. In travel writing, you don't come in as an expert saying, this is how it is. You're saying, this is what I found. And that involves a vulnerability. And as you say, if the writer is somebody who you as the reader really don't like, then you can see it. It's there at the surface. And if they do things that you think are possibly wrong, then you can see it happening. And that's where it's a vulnerable genre.
You mentioned Bruce Chatwin in Dispatches, and the issue of truth leads to a huge debate. In Chatwin's The Songlines, hailed as a groundbreaking travel writing, capturing as it did Aboriginal people's culture and traditions and connection to the land. But it has since emerged that at least some of it was made up. Now, this is something I know you've discussed with various travel writers, fudging, making things up.
Yeah, this is ultimately the central debate, the central ethical question around travel writing, really, particularly when you talk to people who just approach it as a reader, like myself originally, is the question of, is it okay for travel writers to make things up? And generally speaking, readers say no. I mean, if as a reader you find out that a travel writer has been lying, that they didn't go to where they say they went, that they didn't meet the people they say they met, then you have a problem with that. And some writers are pretty far to that end of the spectrum. I mean, Chatwin played very, very fast and loose with what he experienced on the ground. Lots of other writers, people like Philip Mars and Colin Thubram, will tell you if you ask, no, I'm very strict. I report exactly what happened. But these people are producing literary narratives. They're not producing journalistic reports. And when you push people, when you put people on the spot, you find that generally they'll acknowledge that, they do make a composite character here and there. They might move things around a little bit. They might write of meeting someone not quite where they actually met them. Sometimes to protect identity, sometimes just to make the narrative work better. So actually, travel writing, and I think probably any first-person narrative writing, memoir and so on, is actually haunted by fiction. And I think we as readers sometimes kind of are willfully blind when we read. Because if you think about it, that level of detail, that level of total recall, the conversations that are reconstructed but that haven't been recorded like this one, haven't been taken down shorthand, there has to be a degree of fictionalisation going on there.
Tim, I thank you for your contribution to our programme. Tim Hannigan, author of The Travel Writing Tribe, Journeys in Search of a Genre, published by Hurst & Company in London.